Hello and welcome to the continent's greatest podcast, The Europeans. This is Katie in Paris and I'm joined by Ein Berliner, Dominic Kramer. How's it going, Herr Kramer?
Hey, it's fine. This is my last week in Berlin. So from next week, I'll be back home in Amsterdam. Yay!
Yay! Well, not so yay, because I enjoyed visiting you there and it's nice.
Oh, it was lovely having you here. And yeah, it's an amazing city. But I am ready to go home after 2 months to live with my husband and settle into our new house, which my husband is doing without me. Thank you.
That was very well organized on your part. Well done.
I know. Oops. He spent the whole day emptying the house and then he's going to spend the next days filling the new house.
It's going to look perfect by the time you get there.
It better.
Thomas is whipped.
How's your week been?
It's been good. Not much really happened this week, apart from I finally have a working toilet again.
Yay.
I didn't get around to mentioning this last week, but after my amazing visit to see you in Berlin a couple of weeks ago, I got back to Paris to just find this big hole where the toilet had been. There was a small misunderstanding with the guy who is redoing our bathroom at the moment. And
he thought you didn't want a toilet anymore.
Yeah, apparently it's like all the hipsters, they don't have toilets anymore. You just go in a bucket. That's the in thing. But yeah, I've been camping over the road at former Europeans guest Patrick's place. Thank you very much, Patrick, and lovely wife Carol for having me to stay. But now I'm back and I have a toilet. Every time I flush it, I just experience this rush of joy that I have access to this amazing thing. I love toilets.
Oh, I think that may be oversharing.
Yeah, maybe. But anyway, toilets aside, things are also on the up because we have guests again.
Yay.
Last week we had no interviews. This week, separate interviews. Controversial.
Yeah, so I am, just before I head back to the Netherlands, I'm going to be heading to the offices of the European Parliament in Germany, speaking to the big boss there, Herr Frank Piepler, head of the German liaison office. I'm going to be picking his brains about the upcoming 2019 European elections and to find out what they actually do in a liaison office of the European Parliament.
That sounds very exciting. I'm sure it'll be much more exciting than it sounds.
Than I made it sound. Oh, thanks.
I didn't mean it like that.
Who are you speaking to? And you make it sound exciting.
No, I just wanted to say that, like, I've been struggling to get excited about the European elections and I'm looking forward to being armed with a whole list of reasons after I've heard it about, like, why they matter.
Why is it exciting?
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Oh, God.
No pressure.
Who are you interviewing?
I am going to be having a quick chat with Sally Eschun from Are We Europe? She is a journalist based in the Netherlands, and we're going to be chatting about that thorniest of subjects, freedom of speech, and how that looks a bit different depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on. So that is all to look forward to. Another thing.
Yes.
Before I forget, quick throwback to last week when we were chatting about the use of antibiotics in farm animals. Firstly, I had to write about that at work today, so I felt super well equipped. So thank you, Dominic, for filling me in on the basics last week.
I did a great job.
You did. Well, this is the thing. So much more importantly, we got this lovely message from a listener in the Netherlands, Ilse Smit. Ilse studies animal agriculture at Wageningen University. So she was like basically the perfect person to answer our many, many questions that we had about how antibiotics work in animals. And she went to the trouble of writing this, like, this entire Google Doc full of information about it, which I just thought was the loveliest thing.
That's so nice of her. And there's also been more news about antibiotics this week, hasn't there? Which is why you're writing about it. The European Parliament passed restrictions on the use of antibiotics in farming.
They did. So thank you very much for that, Ilse. I really love how well informed our listeners are about all kinds of things. They know much more than we do.
Yeah.
Maybe they should start their own podcasts. It has been a bad week for Italy's ruling populists. A big old row has broken out over Italy's annual budget. So the Italian government, like all governments, has to come up with a budget for next year. And because they're populists and because populists enjoy pleasing the people by giving them stuff that they want.
Without any consequences.
Yeah, just like give people stuff, give them sweets. The populists in Italy came up with a budget which increases public spending. All well and good, except there's one big problem with that. Italy's debt is absolutely massive. They've got about 2.3 trillion euros worth of debt right now. More debt than anyone else in the EU, except for Greece, which is like a whole other story. They're supposed to have debt of 60% of the size of the whole economy or less. They've actually got 131%. So not great. The EU took one look at these crazy amounts of debt and said, like, nah, you're going to have to come up with another budget which cuts your spending and helps to bring this debt under control. And this is actually a really big symbolic moment for the EU because it's the first time the EU has ever said to a government, here is a thing which once upon a time would be totally a matter of national sovereignty. And we're going to tell you that it's not okay and you're going to have to change your plans. You've got 3 weeks, come up with something else. So as you can imagine, the Italian government really loved being told off in this patronising fashion by Brussels. And Matteo Salvini, the far-right interior minister, basically told them, bugger off, we're going to stick with our budget. The problem is, it's down in the EU rulebook that if a country breaks these rules, then the EU can fine them. Quite a lot of money, actually. In theory, in Italy's case, up to 3.4 billion euros.
Wow, the EU are really showing some muscle at the moment, aren't they? After triggering that Article 7 for Hungary and Poland.
Naughty, naughty.
Naughty, naughty.
One thing I will just say, though, is that it's unclear for now how much Italy actually would get punished for breaking the rules. So France has broken the rules on how big its deficit should be for 9 years. And it got off scot-free because, well, it's France and it's one of the biggest countries in the EU. And just like, relax, stop trying to enforce the rules all the time. And countries like Germany and your country, Dominic, the Netherlands, kept getting really pissed off that France didn't get punished for being so relaxed about their discipline.
It's real double standard. It's just like, you know, at school when the kid who always gets told off really badly, but the kid who's like thought of as a goody-goody gets away with doing the same thing.
I was that kid. I used to eat yogurts in class and got away with it.
Oh, actually, I was going to say that was me, but it wasn't me because I never did anything wrong. I was too well behaved.
Oh, you little goody-goody.
I know. Isn't that boring?
It's boring. Speaking of goody-goodies, who... Is that a good segue?
Yeah, that is good.
Who's had a goody-goody week?
The European Parliament have been goody-goodies this week. They have passed a bill to ban single-use plastics. It looks like the bill will be in effect around 2021, at which point there will be a ban on plastic cutlery, plastic cotton buds, straws, drink stirrers, and balloon sticks, which you'll be sad about, Katie.
Oh no, not the balloon sticks.
I know. So they chose items that already had workable alternatives. I'm not sure what the workable alternative to plastic balloon sticks are.
Your hand?
Yeah, good point.
Just like hold it. But a string.
Oh, string. Also good point. No, but the good thing about a balloon stick is like when it's not got helium in it, it still like stands upright. Whereas with a piece of string, the balloon will just flop down to the floor.
You recently played a clown in the opera, so maybe that's why you know that much about balloons. But I'm out of my depth here. I don't really know how balloons work. Anyway.
Okay, last week I didn't know enough about antibiotics. This week we don't know enough about balloons, but I'll keep going.
There's always more to learn. It's good.
Yeah, it is. But there are like a whole chunk of products that the EU claimed they're currently harder to find substitutes for. So for those products, they've set only a mandatory 25% reduction in the usage of them. This is things like burger boxes and sandwich wrappers. And I'm really confused by this because surely the burger box has a really obvious non-plastic example. I mean, go to McDonald's or Burger King and your burger box will be made out of paper, not plastic.
Yeah, paper box.
So I really don't understand why the plastic burger boxes aren't also in this category. And I want an answer.
It's probably the powerful burger lobby at work here. It's the kebab lobby.
At work where?
We've actually spoken about them on this podcast, about how in Germany, like the kebab lobby is really powerful.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Genuinely could be a factor here.
Let's do some investigation. So they're also insisting that drink bottles must be recycled at a rate of 90% by 2025, which is pretty high. And why is this all such good news? I hear you cry. I mean, you probably don't cry that. Everyone knows plastic's bad. But it's not just because plastic looks ugly in the sea and in places of natural beauty. It's like really obviously bad for marine wildlife as well. And it's pretty terrifying that we all eat microplastics all the time. That is one of the worst things. And I was reading today that we don't only ingest microplastics when we're eating fish because they eat plastic in the sea. No, there's thoughts that food that is wrapped in plastic may leave little plastic particles in the food. And that
like on the surface of the sandwich kind of thing?
On the surface of the sandwich. And also there's evidence that there are just like plastic particles floating around the air that we just ingest when we're walking around.
Oh God, I can't even breathe anymore.
Yeah, it's still not quite clear what the effects of microplastics are on human health, but researchers are looking into it and they're worried about how it affects our guts, how it affects our immune system and the way our hormones function, to name just three things. So we need to do everything we can to cut down the amount of plastic in our food. And it seems like this legislation is a step in the right direction. Overall, the products that are included in this bill account for 70% of all marine litter, which is quite great, actually. There are still feelings that this bill doesn't go quite far enough, but I think most people agree that this bill is a step in the right direction. The EU will now have to negotiate with individual member states, and we will keep you posted if there are big developments. This podcast is supported by Future Europe, a new podcast from the European Investment Bank. Katie wants me to clarify that the European Investment Bank is nothing like Goldman Sachs. They fund nice projects like
trains.
Train projects.
And infrastructure. Lots of different types of infrastructure, which is, funnily enough, what this podcast is all about. Since they're into futuristic stuff and development projects, they've put together a little podcasting series about projects they've invested in. One for every EU country, celebrating all kinds of technical innovation around Europe. So there's one about Sweden going cashless. There is one about lasers in Hungary. There's one about designing smart cities in Belgium.
And one thing that's really nice about them is that they're really short, only about 7 minutes each. Nothing like the half hour you have to invest by listening to us rabbit on.
It's the perfect amount of time for, I don't know, what do you get done in 7 minutes? Bit of washing up?
Oh, or to do one of these like high intensity workouts.
Oh my God, yes. What better way to accompany your jumping jacks than a short podcast from the European Investment Bank? They're about all kinds of weird and wonderful things. Here's a little clip from the episode about Sweden going cashless.
You are in the Stockholm old town. I am Joel, and this is my store Antikvariat Verklighetsflykt, which is the escapist bookstore, and I'm an iSettle user. But I'm happy about it. It's a handy system. When I started working in stores a long time ago, we had this hand-cranked cash machine. That's pretty far from this, I would say. And we also handled cash money, which never happens anymore in Sweden.
So the series is called Future Europe. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll post the link in our show notes. So I'm now going to head over to the offices of the European Parliament in Germany, which is very exciting. I visited the other day with Katie when she was here, so I've actually been there already. And as she mentioned before, I've seen inside the gadgets cupboard.
We actually said that it was the European Commission offices, for which we would like to apologise, because that was wrong. It does say it on the sign, though, in our defence.
I think we did say Parliament at one point, and then we said Commission the other time. We should know better.
We should know better.
But I'm going to be meeting Christopher Lade, who works in the liaison office, and his boss, Herr Frank Piplat. They are running a campaign to like boost awareness about the European elections that are coming up next month.
Not next month.
I mean, next year.
Oh my God, you know nothing.
I get confused with months and years in my brain.
It's very hard.
Yeah, it is very hard. Do you know the date of it, Katie?
29th-ish of May, isn't it?
It's the 23rd to the 26th of May, so
you were
a little bit off, but almost.
Close enough. I've got to confess a few things about these elections.
Go on.
I have never voted in an EU election, and I'm like really interested in Europe. So that's not great. And I think it does kind of generally reflect the level of interest that there is in EU elections. This time, obviously, I am going to vote, though. The last time, just in my defense, last time I was in Hong Kong and I didn't get around to sorting out like how to vote as a foreigner in time. And the time before that, I was 22 and much less interested in European politics.
You were studying politics at university.
I know. It is really bad. I can't quite put my finger on why these elections have always felt so distant to me. I think part of it is that like the way that the system works, you don't have like one MEP who represents your local area. So that makes it kind of more difficult to kind of identify specific people. And I've got to put my hands up and say that as part of the MSM, the media, we're also to blame for this because we don't really cover European election campaigns in obviously at all the same way that we cover national election campaigns. It just doesn't get the airtime. Like, I feel like generally, like, what is at stake hasn't really maybe been that well communicated in the past by the EU as well. So I'm like super interested to hear what Frank has to say about how they're trying to fix that.
I do feel like this election is a bit different.
Why is it different?
Well, it feels like we're really at a crossroads with Europe and that the battle lines have been drawn between the nationalist anti-Europeans and the pro-European progressives, or not actually only progressives, the pro-Europeans.
Globalists.
Yeah. Globalist cucks.
But yeah, it does feel a bit like a battle for Europe's soul to some extent. That's true. It is a different election.
It is. So you've never voted in an election, in an EU election. Well, I have, which also explains why I'm going to this meeting and you are not. I'm glad you're not there. Otherwise, I'd be very embarrassed.
You're also in Berlin and I'm not.
Oh, okay. Yeah, fine. Whatever.
Anyway, go over there.
Okay. Bye.
My name is Frank Piplat. I'm the head of this liaison office of the European Parliament.
We are also joined by Christopher. Could you introduce yourself as well,
please? Hi, I'm Christopher Laid. I am one of the new trainees here at the European Parliament liaison office here in Berlin. And I'm here to talk to you today about the campaign that we are doing for the European elections coming up.
What are you hoping to do with this campaign?
So we are not working for one party. Our aim is to raise the participation in the European elections. The first direct European elections took place in 1979. Participation was quite good in 1979, but subsequently it went down for several elections. That came to a stop 5 years ago. In some countries it went up. For example, in Germany it went up by 5 percentage points. And we are hoping to help to increase voter participation.
We want people to vote. That is our main goal. So we want the campaign to be from the citizen for the citizen. And so therefore we are trying to involve the European citizens to create their own campaign. So if you have a listener that says, okay, I'm going to go on to thistimeimvoting.eu. What does that mean? What do I do? So you go online and you sign up and you then have three options. The first option is to pledge to vote. It's kind of like a promise to yourself. So as of today, we have over 76,000 people that are registered and pledged to vote, which is great. And what's also nice is that we are seeing about a 67% increase of that number every week, and that percentage is then getting bigger and bigger. So that's option number one. Option number two is then you get your own special recruiter link, and the idea is that you can then share it with your friends. So you can then post on Facebook, hey, I pledged to vote in the European elections in 2019, May the 23rd to the 26th. And then if your family and friends, they see it, then they can click on that link and then they go directly to the site so they themselves can register. And then the third thing that one can do is that you can then decide to become more active. For example, we have a girl that talked to her professor at a university here in Germany, and she has now convinced the professor to make the European election campaign a part of the curriculum in the class. Very cool.
That's great.
Very, very cool. And we are trying to encourage young people throughout Germany to set up their own events in their own respective cities.
Do you feel like this election is different?
This is a very important election. You know, many things are changing. It's probably more important than it was ever before to go to these elections and to make a decision who should be the people to make decisions in the European Parliament. So, yes, I think these are very, very important elections and probably more important than the ones we had before.
We have just gotten the latest numbers from the European Parliament, what is called the Eurobarometer, which is essentially a large survey. And we are seeing the biggest numbers of support for EU membership ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall. The one piece of data that is unfortunately not the best is that only 41% could call the correct date for the European elections. But none of it really matters if you don't.
But Christopher, I don't think that number is bad. I think that's quite good. You know, it's so early, and 41% of the people who were asked knew about this date. That's not a bad number, I would say.
No, but we would like to see it be 100%.
Yeah. Okay, but that's what we're aiming at. But
that's what we're aiming
at. We still have time for that. I want to come back just very briefly to what you said. You know, why is there so much support now by Europeans for the European Union and European integration? And I think that's quite obvious because the political situation in the world has become quite difficult in the recent past, starting with the UK wanting to leave the EU, more nationalism developing. So people have this feeling more and more, the feeling why the European Union was even started, because of the wish and the idea that when Europeans stand together, they will feel safer, they can achieve more, they will have more stability than when they have to stand alone as individual country. And this feeling is now growing more and more. And this is kind of the original feeling why the European Union was started. It was a peace process, it was a peace program. Maybe this was even a little bit lost, you know, there were some people saying, you know, maybe this narrative of peace is not so valid for the EU anymore. No, it's absolutely true, and it's there. And that's why people and the support has been growing in the recent past, I think.
I like this campaign. I like that it's not telling you who to vote for, but just telling you, go and vote. It's kind of difficult to disagree with that.
In case you didn't get it in that interview, the website that you should go to is
thistimeimvoting.eu. And I think the website is available in every EU language. So if you speak French, for example, why not visit cettefoisjevote.eu?
Now it's your turn to do an interview, Katie.
Oh, go on then. If you have been diligently listening to the Europeans, you'll know that we've been having a little chat every week for the last few weeks with some of the writers from Are We Europe, which is a very slick and beautiful magazine about all things continental. Their latest issue is about Europe's relationship with America. And it talks about everything from politics to how Netflix is about to get a lot more European. This week, I rang up Sally Eschun to talk about the piece that she's written for the magazine, which is about kind of the issue of our times, really, freedom of speech.
So my name is Sally Eschun, and I work as a legal intern at a NGO focusing on women's rights, and then I'm also a freelance writer.
So you've written this piece in Are We Europe about freedom of speech, and it was actually one of my favourite pieces in this issue's Are We Europe. And you argue in this piece that when it comes to the balance between freedom of speech on one hand and the need to prevent hate speech on the other hand, in that fight, American courts have a much stronger record of coming out in favor of freedom of speech. And in Europe, it's kind of the other way around.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
Well, in Europe, we have this history not too long ago where freedom of speech was very much constrained and restricted. And we saw that hate speech can really harm people to just an unprecedented effect. And I think that just because the US didn't have that history, and also you have to remember the United States was founded on the idea to be independent from England, and that freedom of speech should be in fact free from the kingdom. So they have just a different sort of sense of origin when it comes to freedom of speech.
So you get court rulings in the US saying things like, the KKK can burn crosses. The baker who said he didn't want to make a cake celebrating a gay wedding, he might not have won his case in Europe, you suggest. And Holocaust denial as well is illegal in quite a lot of Europe, which you mentioned might surprise quite a lot of our American listeners and even European ones. You wrote about Charlottesville, this nationalist rally in the US last year where Nazis were basically out in the streets burning tiki torches. And you said that watching it from Europe, it looked like a colorized World War II film. Is it really that different from what we've seen recently in Europe? And I'm thinking specifically about big right-wing anti-immigrant marches in Chemnitz in Germany, for example.
Right. It's interesting because I think people would have looked at Charlottesville very much in a different way, let's say 5 or 10 years ago from a European perspective. And just because we have that happening right here at the moment, it's maybe not as surprising just because the whole situation concerning freedom of speech and freedom of expression, freedom of the press is really problematic anywhere in the world right now. It's not just It has been happening for decades in countries in Asia and in Africa, and I think the fact that it's happening right in front of our doorstep really sheds a different light on it.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I don't think I will ever be able to make my mind up about what the right balance is between freedom of speech and not letting fascists say their stuff. But for you as a European, do you generally think that we have a better balance on this side of the Atlantic, or do you think the American approach is a better approach?
Well, I think our approach is actually very admirable. And also, for example, the European Court of Human Rights. So we have a provision that guarantees freedom of speech. And even there, there's a sub-article saying that it can be restricted in some cases. So I think that the European system and European courts on a European level as well as on a national level really do try to balance that out. And now with technology, it's even more difficult. But that just proves that we have to work on freedom of speech and defending it constantly.
What do you mean that it's more difficult due to technology?
Just because of social media. So there are currently laws in Germany and France being discussed where it actually to some degree criminalizes hate speech. And in Germany, the laws are not that new just because of German history and etc. But now they have new legislation passed really focusing on hate speech online. And the question was whether you should be holding, for example, Facebook or Twitter accountable as opposed to the person actually writing these hateful posts. And in Germany, the case is actually that it is Facebook's responsibility to take these down. But then the next question is, person working at Facebook now has to really make up the question as to what counts as hate speech or not. And even though I agree that it is to some extent Facebook's responsibility, it is also difficult from their perspective to just determine that, just because you also don't want to restrict free speech online.
So if you want to read more of Are We Europe's magazine, you can go and check it out online, or you can buy a beautiful edition to hold in your very own hands with 15% off if you use the discount code EuropeansPod.
Do it.
Happy ending. This story comes from an e-cigarette shop in the suburbs of Charleroi in Belgium. Six young men walked into a shop and started roughing up an owner and demanding money from the till.
Oh no.
Sad, isn't it? The owner spent some time trying to befriend them, and eventually he made a suggestion. He said that if they come back after closing hours, he'd be able to give them around like 2,000 or 3,000 euros instead of the measly 1,000 that he currently had in the till. Amazingly, and perhaps stupidly, they took him up on this offer and came back at 5:30. But he told them to come back when they were closed, and they closed at 6:30. So he was like, hey, guys, come back at 6:30 when it's closed.
God, they're really bad robbers.
Really stupid. So they also couldn't really tell the time. Once again, they agreed to his terms, and the owner, Didier, had called the police in the meantime, who were very skeptical that the burglars would return. They were like, we're not really sure this is going to work. But they did indeed come back a third time at 6:30 to find the police hiding out the back, ready to arrest them. Happy ending.
Oh, no. Worst robbers ever.
And finally, an unequivocally happy ending for once.
Well, that must have been quite scary for Didier, but he really won that. Nice one, Didier.
Yeah, and actually, it's not a happy ending for the five guys.
Because they're all going to prison.
Yeah, well, I don't know what's happening to them. One of them escaped.
The cleverest one.
He ran away, the clever one, yeah. And I actually feel like we shouldn't celebrate the downfall of anyone, even if they've tried to rob an e-cigarette shop.
This is a good learning experience for them, you know? Like, they're clearly trainee robbers. And when they get out of prison, maybe they'll do a better job next time.
That's not a happy ending.
Joking, joking. Obviously, we very much hope on behalf of the people of Belgium that there won't be a next time.
One of my favorite things about the story is I watched a video interview on CNN with the owner, and they describe it as a coup de bluff. Is that a real thing, Katie?
Coup de bluff?
Bluff as in bluff, B-L-U-F-F, like he bluffed them.
Coup de bluff.
I really like that. It's my new favorite French phrase. Oh, what a coup de bluff.
You should use that all the time.
I will.
The Belgian robbers may have been pretty dumb, but next week's guest is smart. I won't ruin it for you, but we're going to be talking about old paintings and stuff, clever stuff like that.
Ooh, exciting.
Is exciting.
If you can't wait until then to hear more from us, then check out our Instagram, Europeans Podcast, our Twitter handle, @EuropeansPod, or send us an email, EuropeansPodcast@gmail.com.
We're also on Facebook. I feel like we haven't been telling people that recently. But you can check us out on Facebook. We're there sometimes. Come and say hi.
We've been there quite a lot recently, actually.
Yeah, a little bit. You posted that lovely story about the otter. Was it an otter?
Beaver.
A beaver who really helpfully was nibbling at this tree and managed to sort of like fell the whole tree just perfectly so it fell on this couple's yacht. It was a great story.
Yeah. Good week for the beaver. Bad week for the couple who had thousands of euros of damage worth done on their boat.
Good week and bad week in one fell swoop. Have a great week, everyone.
Tschüss. Bye, Germany.
Bye.